Sunan Nasa'i, Sunan Darqutni, and many others. They use this you know, expression, alayhi salam, after the name of Ali bin Abi Talib, alayhi salatu wasalam. So the Wahhabis don't follow the Muslims of the first generation, no. Actually, a very interesting example is of Bukhari. In Sahih Bukhari, it seems he knew that it is important to give a distinctive status to Ahlul Bayt compared to all others, Azwaj as well as Ashab. One example that I would like to share with you, you know, when he mentions the name of Ali, not all the time, but there are instances, the name of Ali, the name of Hassan, the name of Hussein, even the name of Ali Zainul Abideen, Imam Bukhari in Sahih Bukhari says, alayhi salam. More interestingly, is that when he writes the name of Fatima al-Zahra, 26 times Bukhari has mentioned her. To every instance, every time he writes the name of Fatima al-Zahra, he writes, alayhi salam.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to another edition of Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we'll look at a trending news story and we break it down from an Islamic perspective. This week, we'll be looking into one of the Muslim world's great heroic personalities, specifically a famous cleric who was born in Iran but rose to become one of Lebanon's most important figures for the past 100 years. Imam Musa Sadr played a pivotal role in uniting a bitterly divided Lebanese nation and started the process of a Shia fight back against Israel in the formerly occupied South Lebanon until his shock disappearance in 1978. Here is a brief look at the life and legacy of this towering figure.
Lebanon has been a key battlefield in the regional fight against Western-backed colonialism, and all too often the victim of Israeli regime crimes. Today, Lebanon has developed the means to resist these threats, but where did Lebanon's resistance begin? The answer most might give would be one name, Sayyid Musa Sadr. Imam Musa Sadr was a highly revered Shia cleric of Iranian descent who rose to prominence in Lebanon during the Civil War period. Arriving in Lebanon in 1959 to work for the rights of Shia Muslims in the port city of Tyre, south of Beirut, he rapidly grew to one of Lebanon's most influential figures. Credited as the man who gave Lebanese Shia a sense of community cohesion, he famously worked towards ending the bitter sectarian conflicts dividing Lebanese along religious lines. He further gained acclaim for his work to improve Shia infrastructure, including new schools and charities. Later, in response to oppression of Arabs at the hands of Israel and other foreign actors, al-Sadr founded the Lebanese Amal movement in 1974. This began the snowball effect, which would eventually lead to further resistance and the total defeat of Israel in Lebanon. Unfortunately, one of his most famous aspects is his mysterious disappearance during a visit to Libya in 1978. Saad, along with two companions, vanished before a scheduled meeting with Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. Saad's legacy endures as a symbol of resistance, advocacy for marginalized communities, and commitment to social justice. His supporters and family members continue to fight for information and justice following his traumatic disappearance.
Well, we're honored to have with us today Dr. Luai Sharafuddin, the nephew of Musa Sadr, a member of his family who knew the Imam personally and remembers well what life was like before and after his disappearance. Assalamu alaikum, Doctor. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. Just tell me, do you remember your uncle really well, and what was he like?
Yes, he's my maternal uncle, first degree, my mother's brother. And 1978, when he disappeared, when he was kidnapped, whatever you want to call it, I was almost 14. So I do remember him very well. Of course, I remember the loving uncle, the loving figure of the family, basically the hard rock and that the family counts on. The loving hand that rubs on everybody's shoulder, the shoulder that everybody cried on or alluded to, a shelter, you name it. He was all of these characteristics. Of course, he always showed how much he cared. Every time we saw him almost weekly. My family and I used to live in Tyre in the south, and he was in Beirut. So we would visit him almost every weekend, and so on a weekly basis, we used to meet and see him. Every time we met, he would ask specific questions about studies, about intentions and interests. What books are you reading? Where are you going? What movies do you see? What interests do you have, etc.? So he went after very specific questions to the point that you really feel like this person really cares about me. And he made us feel as if each and every one of us is in a special spot. All he wanted was, his target was the human service. Service to the humanity, making human beings better ones, making society a better society, whether dealing with mothers, fathers, etc. He wanted them to be the best in their role. And in that, he had many stands that proved that. He had a charisma. Of course, that's something that's God-given that he used positively. And used to connect with the people. He really interacted and related to the pains and sufferings of people. And he did not he did not give any attention to the background of the person. All he was after is serving people in need.
And tell me more, Doctor, about the particular movement that he founded, the Amal movement.
Well, basically, he started that movement that you mentioned, and it was not for the Shiites at all. It was a movement of the oppressed, those who are denied their basic rights. And in Lebanon, more than two-thirds of the public do not get their basic rights the basic rights that each citizen is entitled to. So he made a memorandum of understanding among 83 of the well-educated thinkers of Lebanon. 83 thinkers, among them only 8 were Shiites, that signed that later on with the foreign aggression onto Lebanon. Yes, he alluded to He tried over and over and over to have the government protect the people militarily, socially, and living-wise. He thought that the people can resist foreign aggression if they had the basic needs to stay there and live in their villages and in their places. The government was not responsive. He thought that the Lebanese army should be the one to protect the borders against any foreign aggression. The government, again, was not responsive. In 1969, the government gave up totally on South Lebanon and almost withdrew just about the major troops from there. So he had to elude to the public defending each country, each village would to protect its own self with the basic weapons they have. And usually they were not really weapons, probably hunting weapons, axes, knives, etc., anything that they have. But basically not to surrender to any foreign aggression and to be on the defensive all the time and be ready for any aggression. Yeah, that movement later on became an armed militia after he was kidnapped and remained to protect the borders of Lebanon against any foreign aggression. And we have seen their action in many spots in Lebanon.
And what about the disappearance? Do you blame the former Libyan leader Gaddafi for his disappearance still?
Gaddafi claimed that the Imam and his two companions left Libya on flight Alitalia 881 on 31st of August 1978, bound for Rome. So the Italians made a very detailed investigation. They investigated the all the employees and all the security check people, Italian people that were working that night, that day. They investigated all the passengers of that flight, including a flight attendant who said that she knew the Imam. She saw the picture. She said, "I've flown first class before, and I was instructed to serve this person, and I would have remembered him had he come, had he been with us, had he in on this flight." And there was another person from South Lebanon among the passengers. He said, "Well, he would have known the Imam had he seen him on that flight." Two people. Two, not three, two people checked into the hotel with, well, the Imam's name, not the Imam's name, the other person, Sheikh Muhammad Yaqub, the person who filled the card of that hotel, filled it with a wrong name. They arrived in that hotel in clergy outfit. Then they went to the rooms and then came back down to the lobby in civilian clothes, sat there for 10 minutes, and then left the hotel, never to come back. So the Italians made an investigation of that, a very thorough investigation, and came out with the fact that the Imam and his two companions have not entered Libya, have not entered Rome, not even as transit. Months later, Gaddafi claimed that his officers, his security officers, found some new evidence, and he appealed that decision. The Court of Appeal of Italy upheld the first decision and came out with a ruling that not only do we uphold the first, keep the first ruling going, but we add to that that the file given to us by the Libyan authorities is falsified. That means the evidence were false. And that's why all the fingers point to Gaddafi and his regime.
Unfortunately, it's still a mystery. But what about the concepts of a potential return? Are you hopeful that he is still alive?
We're still hopeful. Now, If he's alive, he should be about probably 95 by now. We have had other uncles that lived that long. His mother lived for about 100 years before she died in about early 2000. As long as we don't have any evidence, we're still going after the case. We're still demanding what we call release. We still demand for the truth. Besides any efforts to stop us from that, or any pressures. But for any further than any further information, I would rather let the legal team be consulted on this case and be asked about fate and what the intentions are.
Well, thank you very much to the doctor there, Dr. Luai Sharafuddin, for speaking to us from Lebanon, the nephew of the missing imam. Well, joining us today in the studio to talk more about the life and legacy of Sayyid Musa Sadr is Fatima Subaiti, a Lebanese commentator and the granddaughter of Shahid Hadi Subaiti, a comrade and family friend of Musa Sadr. Welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you, of course. Let me just ask you straight away, because one of the interesting facts about this colossal giant of a man was that he wasn't from Lebanon, but rose to prominence there. He was actually from Iran. Mm-hmm. How did he end up going from Iran to Lebanon?
So that's actually a very good question. So initially, in the 1950s, he went to Lebanon, and he met grand scholars like Ayatollah Abdehsan Sharafuddin. Mm-hmm. Okay, and after his demise, you could say that he saw that there was a void in amongst the Lebanese Shia groups. Mm. They were lacking that redirection, that leadership, and you could see that he was a very charismatic man. He was full of energy and he was practical, and the people in the Lebanese society, they were sort of very energetic, and they were also active, and they were the fuel for the left wing. And in essence, you had him coming in as a religious figure from a very well-known religious family, a Hawzawi scholarly background, a family tree of Sayyids who were prominent, you know, in Iran. And, you know, there was in Iraq. He was also the cousin of Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. Mm-hmm. And then he came to Lebanon as well. So at this point in time, he was the only leader that was able to combine the religious and the political dimensions together. And you're talking about before the 1979 Islamic Revolution. At that time, that was really unique. And he was welcomed by all, and he got along with everybody, and he was just, you know, loved. And as a result, you know, he opened up many institutions to actually represent the people and their needs. And he cared so much about the human rights situation in Lebanon.
Well, you mentioned there some of his well-known good works in Lebanon, charities, orphanages, I'm not sure, schools, hospitals,
yeah,
perhaps.
Yeah.
He really did a lot for the community there. How would you assess his achievements in Lebanon? Not just that, but I know, for example, he's considered the one who kick-started gears towards the resistance that we now see, which eventually went on to liberate Lebanon from Israeli occupation.
Course. Yeah, I mean, that was founded by Sayyid Musa Sadr. So he was the one that really cared about the resistance, really cared about the oppressed people of Lebanon, especially when you had like the criminal entity neighboring it. So in essence, he built up the resistance, the Lebanese resistance regiments known as Harakat Amal today. You see that he also cared about the, you know, the works of the people, directing it to its institutions of a social, economical and political nature. So he set up the Supreme Islamic Shia Council of Lebanon. So this is a supreme body that gives a voice for the Shia that could be, you know, spoken at a governance level. And that's one of the other things that he's established. And I believe that was in 1967. He also established a movement for the disadvantaged, caring for the vulnerable people at the society who were living in poverty when the socio-economical status was just really deteriorating. So, you know, he set up cultural and institutional intellectual centres like mosques, festivals and seminars. And you can see the legacy is still today. You've got the, you know, the Amal movement, and you've got even individuals joining the Lebanese resistance today that has helped defeat Lebanon. Help defeat the occupiers of Lebanon. Yeah. So he was very influential, and he was very willpowered in that sense. And he's garnered the votes of everyone, and he was really, really popular. He was a giant of a man,
there's no doubt about it. I think in physical stature he was known to be quite tall, but also what he built in Lebanon was very big. And I also know that he was very well known for breaking down or tackling sectarian divides which had plagued Lebanon during the Civil War era. He was willing to reach out to Christian groups and Druze groups, other sects, not just Muslim as well. So he was a uniting figure. His main focus, I think, was ending foreign occupation and getting foreign players out of Lebanon. That's something he was very strong on. But let me ask you about something which I think is important we discuss on this show, which is the characteristics that distinguish al-Sadr from other scholars of Islam. Can you break that down for us?
Okay, yeah, so he was very direct with the people, so he actually was very open, and he sort of worked from the grassroots, you could say, at street level. So there's no, like, hierarchy in the institutions that he set up. So as a way, like, he treated everybody fairly, equally, and assigned them specific goals to help, you know, the economical, political, social situations. And he was working in, as you said, a multi-religious society at the time. Yes. And he garnered the love and support of everybody by focusing on the absence of the rights and focusing on the human rights of the individuals. And he's established links with people, I mean, abroad. He was received by, like, presidents of republics, and that's a very unique phenomenon for, like, a religious leader to be welcomed by world leaders, because they're not seeing Sayyid Musa Sadr from a lens of danger or threat. At that time, it was pretty unusual, because you had, like, say, for instance, the Muslim Brotherhood, they launch a crackdown on their leaders. Whereas on the other hand, you have Sayyid Musa Sadr, and he was just being, you know, welcomed by everybody. He was open up to the right wings, the left wings, even the Palestinian factions. But he redirected the energy of his people to the Lebanese, you know, the causes, the humanitarian issues that would help serve their interests and their needs.
And I think linking, you know, a kind of a religious figure, a cleric, entering into politics as well and taking the reins of a country, politically speaking, was maybe lesser known in those days. Like you said, it was before the 1979 Islamic Revolution, after all, which kind of, you know, led the way after that fact. But obviously, Mr. Sayyid al-Sadr was kidnapped shortly before that Islamic Revolution that took place. I wonder if there's something that you could mention on that in regards to the indication. Did this indicate something?
So, in essence, you know, it's just still a mystery of what happened. I mean, he garnered the love and support of everybody around him. And, you know, the people who worked under him, okay, they had, like, close ties with, for example, then the Islamic Revolution and, you know, later on Imam Khomeini. And you can see that they fought in the Iraq-Iran war as well. Okay, one of the examples is Martin Mustafa Shamran, who then was promoted as the Defense Ministry of the Islamic Republic as a result. Now, Lebanon, in that sense, wasn't desired to be like a country like Iran, but Sayyid Musa Sadr was that signifying bridge, if you will. And you can see the people today, they echo his stances against Zionism, against Israel being the, you know, the force of evil. And you can see that they have all, you know, joined resistance groups, and they are trying to resist a foreign occupying force. But that all led back to Imam Musa Sadr. So he was like the sort of the spirit that ignited the flames of those people that would like to resist against occupation. Because at that time, you would also think that, you know, there wasn't a da'wah, like the da'wah was really basically geared to theological, intellectual advocacy, not very practical. And he was a very practical man in that essence. So he really seeked to absorb the energies of the individual and mobilize them as well, rather than getting lost in the left wing and right. He actually guarded them under his wing, and he led them through channeling the energies into his institutions to actually, you know, help their situation become better. Whilst himself, he was opening himself to all avenues, including, you know, the Palestinian resistance factions like the Fatah, led by Yasser Arafat at that time. So he gathered the support of everyone, pretty much. So.
He was a uniting figure, there's no doubt about it. And like you say, he was a young guy who was seen in public. He'd walk with the people, speak to the people directly. He wasn't, you know, a sort of elderly figure tucked away somewhere in a house of knowledge, nowhere to be seen, disappeared in a library. He was out there in the public, getting involved in politics, meeting and greeting people, and leading the way directly. But let me ask you about you personally. What does he mean to you personally? What impact has he had on you? This is going to be a brief answer because we're near the end of the show.
So he, for me, is a very influential figure at a time where, you know, there wasn't a practical mobilizing force of people rallying together to fight oppressed nations, because he came in and he combined the politics and the religious dimension. So I think for him, he's a very charismatic, practical man, and he had a vision in mind. And you can see the generations after, you know, they're just echoing his visions and his advice as well, and the stance that he had, you can see it today. And he spoke in the people's language as well, so people were able to relate to him even though he wasn't from Lebanon. So you can see that, you know, how much he was able to penetrate in the hearts and minds of the individuals, and it's affected a lot of people, and you know, they continue to take that today with them.
Fatima, thank you so much for speaking to us. We've learned so much from you today, but unfortunately we have reached the end of this edition of the show. Thank you to our guests, and thank you everyone for at home. Join us again next week for another edition of Iron Islam. Assalamu alaikum for now.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
Germany's economy stagnated in the second quarter of this year compared to the previous 3 months, showing no sign of recovery from a winter recession and cementing its position as one of the world's weakest major economies. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. RT Russia Today has covered this story and tells us more. The Federal Statistical Office, DStatis, reported on Friday, 25th of August, the German government budget deficit surged to 42.1 billion euros in the first half of 2023 amid Berlin's efforts to rein in inflation and energy prices. According to preliminary data, the figure was 37.6 billion euros higher than in the first half of 2022, a nearly tenfold increase. When measured against the gross domestic product, GDP, at current prices, the deficit ratio was 2.1%. According to the German Federal Statistical Office, DStatis, government revenue amounted to 917.2 billion euros in the reporting period, while expenditure was 959.3 billion euros. The latter spiked sharply since last year by 7.7%, largely due to the federal government's relief packages that aim to alleviate the pressure from high inflation and a surge in energy prices. The report stated the brakes on gas, heating and electricity prices and the related hardship clauses applying to hospitals and care facilities caused a sharp rise in subsidies by 45.7% in the first half of 2023, year on year. It noted that additional expenditures came from the reform of federal funding for energy-efficient buildings, which sparked a rise in investment grants. Meanwhile, the government's interest payments were up 38% in the first half of 2023 compared to the same period in 2022. Despite remaining the European Union's largest economy, Germany has been struggling with the fallout from the energy crisis and persistently high inflation since last year. Heavily reliant on energy imports from Russia, the country was among the hardest hit by the reduction in Russian energy deliveries to Europe, which were either significantly curtailed or entirely halted after the European Union imposed sanctions on Moscow in response to the conflict in Ukraine. This resulted in elevated energy costs, which in turn have been driving up prices in other sectors of the economy. According to recent forecasts, energy prices in Germany are likely to remain high until at least 2027, which means that additional support measures may be necessary to avoid another crisis. The Wall Street Journal has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to a survey of companies, business sentiment in Germany weakened in August for the fourth month in a row, and by more than expected, as the economic outlook turns gloomier in Europe's largest economy. Data from the IFO Institute said on Friday, 25th of August, the IFO Business Climate Index declined to 85.7 in August, from 87.4 in July, missing expectations of 86.6 by economists polled by the journal. The reading was the lowest level since October of last year. Clemens Foest, president of the IFO Institute, said companies are increasingly pessimistic about the months ahead. IFO Institute's indicator gauging current conditions tumbled to 89.0 from 91.4 in July, the lowest level since August of 2020. Meanwhile, the survey said its index assessing expectations for the next 6 months also ticked down to 82.6 in August from 83.6 in the previous month. IFO Institute said in manufacturing expectations remained starkly pessimistic, with companies suffering from declining new orders. The business climate index was also weaker on months in IFO's other tracked sectors, services, trade and construction, with the outlook turning gloomier in all three sectors. The survey comes after Germany's economy was confirmed to have stalled in the second quarter of this year after contracting in the first quarter of 2023 and the last quarter of 2022. The IFO index is based on a poll of about 9,000 companies in manufacturing, services, trade and construction sectors. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. Germany's economy stagnated in the second quarter of this year compared to the previous 3 months, showing no signs of recovery from a winter recession and cementing its position as one of the world's weakest major economies. The figure of zero growth for the second quarter of this year was in line with a first estimate published in late July. Year-on-year, adjusted gross domestic product contracted by 0.2% in the second quarter of this year. Quarter-on-quarter, economic activity has fallen by 0.4% in the fourth quarter of 2022 and by 0.1% in the first quarter of 2023. Two consecutive quarters of contraction fulfills the technical definition of a recession. Carsten Brzeski, global head of macro at ING Bank, said, "Both the short-term and the longer-term outlook for Germany looks anything but rosy." Carsten Brzeski said, "Weak purchasing power, thinned out industrial order books, a slowdown in the Chinese economy and the impact of the most aggressive monetary policy tightening in decades all point to weak economic activity in Germany going forward." Friday, 25th of August, as data showed household consumption showed zero growth in the second quarter of this year from the first quarter, and government spending rose by 0.1%. Capital investment also grew modestly, whilst exports fell by 1.1%. Pantheon Macroeconomics forecast gross domestic product, GDP, will post a 0.2% contraction in the third quarter of this year, before a rebound of 0.4% quarter-on-quarter in the last quarter of this year. That would mean that Germany's gross domestic product falls by 0.2% year-on-year in 2023. Melanie de Bono, senior Europe economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics, said, "If our forecasts for the rest of the big four Eurozone economies are correct, this means Germany will be the worst-performing economy among them." According to a monthly report published on Monday, 22nd of August, the Bundesbank expects economic output to remain largely unchanged in the third quarter of this year. The report claimed a resilient labour market, strong wage increases and declining inflation should boost private consumption, but it admitted industrial production will remain weak because of sluggish foreign demand. Also, the Bundesbank said Germany's economy will likely stagnate again in the third quarter of this year as weak demand from abroad and high interest rates take their toll on Europe's industrial powerhouse. Germany's central bank said in its monthly report, after preliminary estimates suggested that the economy recorded zero growth in the second quarter of 2023, the outlook for the July to September period was not much better.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we try to answer your queries, your issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. And the answers are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his verified family. Well, today we have the pleasure to be with Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member at Al-Mustafa University. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Yes, thank you very much.
Well, Professor, how can parents help their children in character development, like, you know, fostering positive character traits, like including gratitude, forgiveness, empathy, or like generosity, even responsibility and self-discipline?
Yes, as we have been mentioning before in previous episodes, that the important thing is to provide role models and to explain to them how the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam behaved in their relationships with others and even themselves. So in all the examples that we find, in all the characters that we have in Islam, the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, all of them are examples of the traits that are there,
right,
have to be there. So our children should get acquainted with the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt. The Quran and the Ahlul Bayt, those two precious things. That the Holy Prophet has left behind for us. And they are to remain together. Their remaining together doesn't mean that you hold the Holy Quran in one hand and maybe another book of the Ahlul Bayt in the other hand. No, that is not something that's just metaphorical. The important thing is these two are interconnected.
Okay.
They cannot be separated. If you want to understand the Quran, you need to know the Ahlul Bayt. If we want to know the Ahlul Bayt, we need to understand the Quran. The Quran, the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, are the practical manifestation of the Quran.
Right.
So we need to our children to learn the Quran. We need to our children to understand the Quran. They should be able to recite the Quran. They should be able to memorize the Quran. They should be able to think deeply about the Quran. Then they should be able to relate the Quranic teachings to the behavior of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, how they behaved.
Right.
And how their whole life was for the sake of the Quran, to implement the Quran. There weren't two types of lives they had. One type secular, the other religious. No, all of their lives was for the sake of the Holy Quran and the implementation of the Holy Quran in all their lives. So our children need to understand both of these things from day one. They need to be taught about them, whether it is peace or war, whether it is economic issues, whether it is social issues, whether it is political issues, all of them have to be understood under the umbrella of the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt.
Right.
If we want to discuss about our personal issues, we refer to the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt. If we want to discuss about our society and we want to talk to our children about them, then we go to the Holy Quran and find what the message of the Holy Quran is about our society today. For example, in many countries, you have social issues, you have political issues, you have economic problems. The problem with our society is that we are looking for solutions, man-made solutions to problems that can only be solved by referring to the Holy Quran and the Ahlul Bayt. How do we do that? We need to go to the Ahlul Bayt, and we need to study the example, and we need to study how they managed the affairs of the Ummah and how they implemented the Quran. So how do we do that? We need to first start off ourselves, and then we need to find our children and guide our children towards teachers and scholars who can teach them about the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt. This is important.
Right.
It's not like it shouldn't be, look, we do something for them when they go to school, that's something, and going to a madrasa or a maktab is something else. It should be come together. This dichotomy should be removed. I emphasize on the fact that everything should be done under the guidance of the Quran. Even if we want to establish a society where everyone is working towards one goal, and that is Tawheed. And to implement the message of Tawheed, we have to cling on to the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt. And whether in any field. So our children from day one understand the fact that even if they're going to do some job, even if they're going to when they grow up, they need to find a profession for themselves.
Right.
They need to work for an earning. It should be for the sake of the way the Quran has asked us. The Ahlul Bayt has done so.
Exactly. Professor will discuss more on this topic with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is IRIB English Radio. We are with Professor Syed Salman Akavi, and we're discussing about character development in children, and Professor is helping us.
So the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam provide us examples for all aspects of our lives. For example, when we talk about the special relationship with Allah Almighty, when we talk about praying to Allah, when we talk about fasting, when we talk about these are very, it's very clear that everything that is there, which we need, is available in the Quran, and with the help of the Ahlul Bayt, we can understand that. And the books that have been written by our scholars also are based on the Quran and the Sunnah of the Holy Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt. So our children should be groomed in the fact that everything, every guidance we need is from the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt.
Right.
And even if we want to go out for something, doing some social activities, economic activities, especially how to deal with other people. I mean, we say all the time, yes, it's very important to be very, very nice to other people. You need to be polite. You need to be kind. You need to be generous. Yes, that is one aspect. There's no doubt about it. But let me ask you a question. Is it only speaking nicely and politely to people is ethical or moral? Praying and offering salah, isn't something ethical and moral?
Of course.
Of course it is.
The prayers itself, the salat itself, Jesus, the obedience, the,
exactly.
That we should not have pride.
But the moment we say to our children or for ourselves also, we need to be good people. Sometimes some parents are saying, oh, you need to be a good person. You need to be polite. You need to be kind. You need to be generous. Yes, that's important. No, that is important. There's no doubt about it. But on the other hand,
obligatory thanks should not be taken
whatever
lightly.
Allah Almighty has asked us to do in the form of these ritualistic worships that we carry out, they are also based on morals. And
so what are you trying to say? The problem with the parents today is that we most of the times focus on how a child should be nice in the society, how should be polite, how should be forgiving, how should be generous, rather than we should have, these are important things that should be taken care of. But more important than them is to have the knowledge of religious obligations, the wajibat that are there.
I just want to say that this separation between seeing these are ethical and moral values that every human being has to follow, these actions of worship, these are specific actions which are for those who are religious people, they take care of those. No,
it's
it's for everyone. This is religious, both are religious,
hand in hand.
And both are moral and ethical.
Right. And both go hand in hand. We'll discuss more with you on
And especially, I just want to emphasize on the fact that sometimes you can't be polite to people. Sometimes, for example, the Quran says about the mu'mineen, رُحَمَاءُ بَيْنَهُمْ أَشِدَّ عَلَى الْكُفَّارِ. We have to be hard against the...
Towards those who are non-believers, right. Professor, we'll discuss more with you on the topic after a short break. Tell listeners, stay tuned.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we're discussing about character development in children. Professor, you're saying that, first of all the guidances, all the insights that we are instilling in our children should be taken from Quran and Ahlul Bayt, who are the most precious things left behind by our Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa sallam. And we should cling on them ourselves, and also we should take all guidances for our children from these two precious things. Next, you said that once we have morality, ethics, the religious obligations of worship should go hand in hand with the ethics and morals.
Exactly. I want to say, whatever the ethical and moral principles that are maybe universally accepted, that is something religious itself. Religion is nothing more than that. I mean, all the precepts of religion are moral and based on moral issues,
right,
ethical issues and principles. And is even the religious actions that we carry out, the specific ritualistic, liturgical, devotional practice which we do carry out, that is also based on ethical issues. For example, when we talk about salah, and the true form of praying is inna salat tanha anil fahsha'i wal munkar. Now, the true salah, the pure salah, entails that we refrain from carrying out things which are wrong.
Right.
So they are much interconnected. Sometimes being polite to others is moral, is ethical and moral. Sometimes being harsh, for example, there's a person who's carried out a crime. Now you can't be polite to a criminal. You need to punish him, and that is based on ethical principles.
Right.
For example, if you...
So being good all the time is not recommended.
Being humble, yes, you are. But you need to be humble before your parents. You need to be humble before those who are...
Senior to you.
But a bully comes down and you start being humble. That's not going to happen.
That's not recommended.
You need to be stand up to him then. So, I mean, we can't say all the time, if you're humble, if you're polite, if you're generous, then that's good. Sometimes you're generous. I mean, people walking on the road, you're going and there's a beggar and he shows off himself to be a very, person in dire need. And you throw your heart out and you give him so much money. And the other day you find out, no, he's an imposter.
He's richer than you.
Yes, he's richer than me. And the problem is that, no, we're not supposed to shut them up, or we're not allowed to from masala fala tanhar. We don't want to make them run away. We're not supposed to be harsh upon them, but giving them generously more than what they require, that is also not correct. So we need to be balanced in everything we do. So we need to teach our children ethics and principles in a balanced way. Generosity, being polite, being humble, being kind to others, yes, important. But sometimes the manifestation of kindness and mercy is sometimes in the form of a harsh thing. For example, if you want to treat your child, you want to be kind to him, but you give him a bitter pill.
Right. Well, those were very important things that we need to take care of in character development of children. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you want to listen to our programs again, go back to our official website, which is www.parstoday.ir/en. There's a tab, Call of Islam, and you can find an archive of our programs there. Thank you so much for being with us. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. shortwave,
25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.